People believed that the existing tsunami walls were high enough, thought they were safe and did not evacuate, although they could have. If we are serious about this, we need to involve the citizens more.
That was Associate Professor Christian Dimmer, and this is Me, Myself, and Disaster. I'm Josh, and Andrew, what have we got on the show today?
Today, we're joined by Christian Dimmer, Associate Professor for Urban Studies at Waseda University in Tokyo. Christian has a background in urban planning, disaster recovery, and community resilience. Today, we'll be talking with Christian about his experience following the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and the tsunami, and how that shaped his perspective on disaster systems and community resilience.
Let's get this discussion started on Me, Myself, and Disaster.
Christian, welcome to the show.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you.
Now, you were in Tokyo in 2011, on March 11, when at 2:46 p.m. the building started to shake. Can you take us back to that point in the afternoon? When did you realize this wasn't just another earthquake, this was something different?
Well, all of us arriving in Japan were, of course, aware of the earthquake situation here in Japan, the possibility of being hit by a major disaster at any moment. And of course, we've seen many earthquakes, many tremors, and especially in a high building, you realize that and you feel that. So you get to used to that over time. But on that particular day, it just didn't stop. The tremor got stronger and stronger, and I had been on the 11th floor of the Department of Urban Engineering at Tokyo University, and in the room, people looked at each other, and somehow we saw in our eyes the confirmation this is something bigger than usual. And as studied the Japanese students and scholars diving underneath of their tables, taking shelter, bookshelves crashing down, and I think losing it. So I took my computer, and instead of hiding underneath of my desk, standing in the middle of the room, trying to protect my computer and my hard drive with all the data.
Academic.
Yeah, and then we evacuated the building. So people remained very calm. It's very impressive to see that all of that was very well rehearsed. And we left the building in an orderly fashion, leaving out there. And then I moved back home. So it's a 30-minute walk from Tokyo University to where I live. And on social media, we could then already see pictures of the tsunami arriving. So it's very, very unsettling. I should also mention the tremor was very strong in Tokyo, although the epicenter was 400 kilometers up north. And I was expecting, looking out of the window and to see devastation in Tokyo, I was expecting to see fires there, because the neighborhood in front of my window is mostly old wooden buildings at that time. And I was very surprised to see that there was no visible damage at all, other than the building was still shaking. So it's very, very surprising to see that you could have such a strong tremor without visible damage. And on my way home, a couple of tiles coming off of some facades, some very old buildings tilting to the side. But overall, there was no visible damage there. Felt sense of vindication as well. All this earthquake proofing that we've been studying, that we've been seeing over the years, really working out very nicely.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I remember back to all those years. I'd actually had been in Japan a couple of weeks before snowboarding with a group of mates, and I remember being in Australia and watching it on the news and thinking, wow, I was just in some of those places where, you know, the news and some of the pictures that were coming through. And it's really interesting, because when you kind of think about the disaster, many people you know, talk about the Tohoku event, you know, as a triple disaster in terms of the earthquake and then the tsunami that followed after that, and then fires and other things that happened. But it's really interesting. I know that you've stated, or you talk about, that it was actually a quadruple disaster once you look at the demography, once that's included into the equation. Can you explain to us like the various layers of this disaster and how you kind of saw it play out?
Yes. Well, I think other people also saw that, but I think I probably named it early on. Others had it on the radar, but focused on the immediate damage. Usually triple disaster, it's the earthquake causing the tsunami, and then the tsunami hitting the emergency power of the Fukushima nuclear power plant and leading to the critical situation there. So it's usual the usual sequence and the usual perception of how people saw it at that time. For me, on the other side, I couldn't help but to see that there was a kind of different disaster already unfolding. So it's kind of two different speeds and two different intensities. And the triple disaster on March 11th, very strong, very sudden, very immediate, very easy to foreground. But then you have the disaster, the slow disaster, the depopulation, the demographic transition of much of Japan's rural periphery. Especially the regions along the coast were already farther ahead of the aging and the depopulation that the rest of the country will go through.
Yeah.
And on top of that, demographic disaster, the out-migration of young people, the loss of an economic basis, the aging of the average farmer, of the average fisherman, the crisis of depopulating towns, of depopulating shopping streets. On top of that, the triple disaster then happened. And it's not just a semantic quibble, whether we want to call it triple or quadruple disaster, but if we want to build back better, or if we want to build back urban or rural structures that are able to withstand future change, we have to see the whole picture and the whole wicked problem that is unfolding there. If we're only building back to fight off the next tsunami or the next earthquake, but if we ignore the economic transition, the demographic transition, the depopulation, the concentration of elderly folks in all of these towns, can we really build back successfully? Is it really built back better then? So that's the question. So that's why I think it's important to name things properly.
Yeah, no, I think, and I mean, Andrew and I have been on this for a very long time. Like, another key conversation in that space is, you know, the use of the word natural disasters. Like, it's not just about semantics. It's about how it frames the thinking in our mind and what our consciousness looks at or thinks about when we think about these terms and people throw them out. Andrew and I have obviously spent a lot of time in Japan studying over there, studying the disasters, spending time with you last year, actually, filming the documentary. For people that might not understand the context, because you, as you said there, you know, the depopulation of those regional and rural areas in Japan, for people that don't understand, you know, what that trend was looking like before the earthquake and the disaster, can you kind of explain, you know, how bad that was? Like, we hear news stories of, you know, parts of Japan where, you know, there's abandoned houses and they're being sold for, you know, ridiculously cheap prices because the, you know, the children can't afford to pay the taxes or take the properties on, or they've moved back to the city and they don't want to come back. How bad, I guess, was the problem? And then what was that, like, how much did the disaster then accelerate or exacerbate that further?
Interestingly, I have traveled the area years before the tsunami. I have friends up there. I liked Tohoku a lot, so we've been traveling around there. So I knew Ishinomaki from before the disaster. I knew the Oshika Peninsula from before the disaster. And these areas are marked by a concentration of a lot of elderly people. 50, 60, 70% of all people living in these towns and villages can be older than 65 years. The average farmer is older than 65 years. The average forest worker, the average farmer. So it's a huge problem. And then central cities, they had these kind of concentrated shopping streets, the main street that we know from other cities across the world as well. And over the last 15 to 20 years, we saw a proliferation of shopping malls as well. We saw further suburbanization. We saw a development of ever more car-dependent lifestyles as well. So that drained the life of these central shopping streets, and a lot of shops had been vacant already, or shopkeepers were very old, had a very hard time to survive. And therefore, yeah, these towns were very, very hollowed out, and just building back what was there and the minute before the disaster really wouldn't address the structural issues that these towns are confronted with. You think about how this is going to look in 10, 20, 30 years with these demographics continuing as well. For whom are we building back in these regions is the question.
And like, I think as Josh mentioned, like Tohoku for us is probably our favorite part of Japan. We've been down to Kyoto, Osaka, and where all the tourists are, but people don't go generally up to Sendai, Ishinomaki, Rikidzataka, and other places we've been to see the area impacted by the tsunami. But this sort of disaster is not new for Japan. And back prior to the 1860s, Tokyo was destroyed and rebuilt many times, impacted by volcano eruptions, earthquakes, storms, floods, tsunamis, everything else. There was even a fire read about in 1657 that claimed 100,000 lives, and people just accepted this was part of their lives. But what's changed now in that disasters are somehow psychologically unacceptable compared to how they were back in the pre-modern Japan times?
Wow, that's a big question. Okay, let's unpack it. We have to imagine Japan was always confronted with these earthquakes and very peculiar geology here, situated on the Pacific Rim of Fire, as we all know. And over the centuries, it developed this kind of architecture to cope with this situation. So the challenge is then how to best build a city in this kind of situation. Do I want to be buried underneath a brick building, a stone building, or something lighter? So post and beam structures developed, wooden architecture developed, paper walls developed, also owed to the very hot climate in order to keep houses cool in summer. But then at the same time, of course, you become much more vulnerable to fires. So you have these very, very large fire, the Great Meidaiki fire you're referring to from 1657. People not only dying through the fire, but also drowning in the river as they were trying to flee from the flames. And there were, every couple of years, smaller fires where only 1,000 houses, 2,000-3,000 houses burned down. So this was a constant issue to fight with fires. And the term developed the flowers of Edo, as Tokyo was not named in pre-modern periods, referring to the fires. And you can see this in the arts, in wood prints. You see references to this big catfish, which is symbolizing the islands of Japan and symbolizing earthquakes. There's a cultural representation has strongly been influenced through this perpetual cycle of reconstruction and devastation. And Jennifer Weissenfeld wrote a brilliant book about that. So I think we can argue that people just accepted that as an inevitability. What would you want to do about it if you put yourself into the shoes of people back then? You would just see this repeating over and over and over again, and you would kind of settle into that, somehow accepting that this is part of our everyday existence somehow, this possibility of being hit at any moment with something very terrible. So fast forward in the modern period now, after the Meiji Restoration, we see the birth of engineering, of civil engineering. We see that experts are assuming responsibility for disaster-proofing the city. And also this kind of dawning consciousness of the engineer that we can calculate this kind of modernist hubris somehow, that there's nothing we cannot calculate anymore if we just have enough computing power. And so here we see this kind of quiet shift somehow towards the experts, and on the other side, the citizens perhaps starting to believe as well in that narrative, and coming to think that we don't have to pay that much attention anymore. We will be taken care of by the experts and by technology. So it's a very simplified story that I'm telling you here, so we can go much deeper into that, but I hope you get it.
No, I think it's fascinating, and you've obviously just written a paper on it, which Andrew and I couldn't put the paper down, and we'll put it in the link in the podcast for others to read it, because it is a fascinating read around some of those cultural psyches, and I think there are some clear tangibles for us in the Asia Pacific and other countries that I feel like possibly are seeing some of the same psychological kind of impact starting to happen in that modern era and that modern world with engineering. What I'd be interested to understand, as you were kind of saying there, that people are in a sense of almost disengaged because the experts, the government, they've got it sorted, they've got it underhand. How do you think that then translates into the impacts of disasters like Tohoku in modern Japan? What's different, do you think, or what do you think might be the exacerbated impact with this new kind of cultural psyche around this engineering superhero?
Well, that's a very nice paper by Matthias Ishanove and Rahul Srivastava. I can provide you with a link later, and we can put it into the show notes as well. It's called When Tokyo Was a Slum. And in there, they talk about this kind of spontaneous rebuilding of Tokyo after World War II. Talking about this kind of self-help. Of course, you have to put yourself again into this historical context there. Not too many white-collar workers there. A lot of people are craftspeople, people who have this kind of DIY culture. And after the disaster, they just rebuilt. They're not waiting for the government. Andrew Sorensen, in his book, The Making of Urban Japan, describes the 1923 post-disaster reconstruction as well, where we have urban planners with very far-fetched plans and visions, but then people not waiting for the planners, and in some cases, but just rebuilding. Now, today, we don't really have that anymore. Most people work in the service economy, very few craftspeople. And today, if you want to, I'm exaggerating now, but if you want to hammer a nail into a wall, you're almost hiring a contractor to get that done, or to paint your kitchen, or something like that. So we really saw in Tohoku after the tsunami then, a lot of people waiting for the government to move ahead with the reconstruction plans, waiting for construction materials to become cheaper, waiting for contractors to be available. At the same period of time, of course, we had the Tokyo Olympics, so that as well was sucking up a lot of oxygen driving up the raw material prices, steel, concrete, making labor very expensive, leading to massive increases of prices and people just waiting instead of doing it themselves. I think that historic context is very important. Society has changed in those last 80 to 100 years.
Hey everyone, just a quick one. If you're enjoying this chat with Christian, make sure you hit that like or subscribe button on whatever app you're using. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Let's get back to the show. One thing that Andrew and I were interested about, it was one thing that Andrew and I actually spoke about after reading your paper was, do you think any of your research or, you know, any of your observations from on the ground in Japan in terms of, does this same theory around this disengagement from the problem, do you see that in terms of areas that are less disaster frequent? Like, do you actually, like, is the problem actually worse because they've never seen a disaster before in some areas and they think, oh, well, yeah, like they see it obviously in the state media and whatever that, you know, everything's all good. Does it exacerbate it? Or do you feel like that trend isn't as strong in some of these locations that may not have experienced this before or communities that may not have this firsthand experience of disasters?
You mean outside of Japan?
Outside of Japan, but even in other kind of regional rural areas in Japan that might not have seen some of the scale of disasters like Tohoku or other things like some of the great fires. And again, like you kind of think about some of the great fires of, you know, 1657, you go, well, obviously there still aren't people living now, but that, you know, that there's almost like this cultural disconnect as well as you get further away from some of these events.
Well, I think disaster is omnipresent in Japanese media. If a disaster happened, like in the Noto Peninsula, of course, we have this in national newspapers across the country. It's in TV, it's in media, and people talk about it. So I think that's not really a challenge. Then in some areas, we also have these kind of disaster drills, particularly on September 1st, the anniversary of the great Tokyo earthquake of 1923. But this really depends on the community, so we cannot really generalize that. There are facilities here in Tokyo, south of the Skytree. I have to look up the name of it, but it's a kind of training facilities where you can go with your kids. And
we've been there.
Yeah, we visited last time.
We're the kids.
me too. And you can experience how it feels when your car is underwater and how difficult it is to open the door. But how serious is that in the end of the day? How much is it moving you to make you more alert? We see these kind of movable training facilities as well. Sometimes you see them in Tokyo. You have them in front of an office building, and then the office workers are coming out. And then one by one, they're going into this simulated tremor machine there, and they get shook, and they get to experience how magnitude 7 feels. You see the astonished faces. But the question is, how consequential is that? You see it in neighborhoods, in my right in front of my house. In fact, there's a neighborhood park, and they do the disaster drill there as well. But it's the elderly mostly who are doing it. You hardly see anybody younger than 70 years being part of these drills. So. It's a bit of a paradoxic situation. It is everywhere there. You are exposed to it, and yet it is not sure how effective it actually is. And we can see this very, I don't want to say nicely, but we could see this very clearly in the city of Kamaishi in 2011. This came to be known as the miracle of Kamaishi. So in the city of Kamaishi, in Iwate Prefecture, they had this kind of training that they started in the early 2000s. There is this kind of idea in that region of Japan, this Tendenko is the name of it. So you take care of yourself. You evacuate yourself. You're not waiting for anybody. You're not looking back, and you assume that the others are also knowing what they're doing and that they're going to take care of themselves. So in the city of Kamaishi, 99% of the school kids actually survived because they had gone through that kind of training. Their school was supposed to be safe. It was above the tsunami line of the, I think, 1890 Meiji tsunami. So the official manual said you are to stay in that school building and to seek shelter there. So the government and the engineers are saying you're safe there. You don't need to go away. And the kids didn't heed that, actually. They escaped to higher ground repeatedly and thus got away with it. And in other places, like the Oikawa Elementary School in, I think, Ogatsu, part of Ishinomaki, kids evacuated onto the roof of the school, which was 50 meters, 100 meters away from a much higher mountain. And I think nearly everyone perished there because they followed the instructions. So you see, there are drills, there are routines, and in some places they work, in other places they don't. So I think we need to look more carefully into this and to study more carefully, actually, when something functions.
Those things are quite fascinating. And I know Josh we went to the Life Safety Learning Center, went to one of those elementary schools. I think we actually got in trouble at the Life Safety Learning Center because we were having too much fun there. Like, it was actually quite good. And like, looking at the earthquake table and it shakes under the table, where the guy was shouting at us, and I think one of us sprayed each other one there with fire extinguisher at some point. But I mean, it actually, the whole concept of it is actually really good, and something that I often say would be great in Australia. We could actually go, yep, just make it part of everyday life around that disaster preparedness. You mentioned that great Tokyo earthquake, and it made me think that there's, I know you mentioned in your paper that the Tokyo Resilience Project was kind of that big sort of forward document of saying we've gone 100 years since that earthquake. And we're going to look forward to the next 100 years. What does that project propose to do for the next 100 years in Japan?
Well, basically, it's a very long catalog of engineering projects. So we're building further underground rivers in order to deal with stormwater, cutting big evacuation road accesses into the urban fabric, building more parks where we can, and a lot of other engineering projects. But it feels very, there is very little space for the citizens in there. So look into the document. It was created, and then it was given to the citizens for soliciting comments. But the citizens weren't part of the making of the policy. They're not co-creators of the policy as well. So again, it's the engineers, it's the experts who are creating these projects on behalf of the citizens. And if you look into the promotional materials as well, the subtext is always, we, the responsible government, are creating a city so that you can live happily and to live there at peace and ease your mind so that you don't need to worry about the disaster, which is exactly the opposite of the old Japanese culture of disaster. Of course, you were always thinking about the possibility of disaster, and it probably didn't feel good. And you wouldn't feel too happy all the time thinking about the possibility of a great devastation at any moment in time. But then you were alert when the disaster happened, and you knew how to react as well. So you can really see old footprints as well. I think of the 1923 fire, where people are taking out their paper windows and they carry them away in order to save them from the flames for rebuilding their house after the disaster. So you see how cold-blooded that is, where everything is burning. You're already trying to salvage, or still trying to salvage, building components that you know you will need for rebuilding your house afterwards. And today, this isn't really there anymore. So we do have scholars like Philip Brown, who suggested as well that in Tohoku, people believed that the existing tsunami walls were high enough. They believed that in the forecasts of tsunami heights, and thought they were safe and did not evacuate, although they could have because there was enough time. So I really think that if we are serious about this, we need to involve the citizens more in the plan making, and perhaps also in the mapping of hazard zones, rather than giving them the maps. Look, this is your neighborhood and this is where it is dangerous. Wouldn't it be better maybe to have another year time, and you actually go out with citizens in the different parts of your administrative territory and actually map what they think is dangerous, and therefore getting them more involved and getting them more thinking. And that probably this kind of much deeper involvement will help later on with evacuation then, rather than just giving them a map.
I love the start of your answer there, because when Josh and I were there last in Tokyo, we went up to the underground drainage channel and saw that, which is this massive cavern of engineering that diverts water away from, to avoid flooding in parts of northern Tokyo. We've seen the massive seawalls on Ishinomaki and along the northern coast there. And I just want to read a quote from your paper. You say, in the Tokyo Resilience Project promotional video, citizens only appear as passive props who enjoy a carefree private life in streets and green parks, while experts in faraway control rooms are the invisible guardians that guarantee safety. And that made me laugh when I read that, actually, because I thought, oh, that's so, like, we can't engineer our way out of these solutions or out of these problems. It's like this the solution is throw money at concrete and steel and fix a problem that way. And it made me think, when we're over there while studying this Churchill Fellowship in community mobilization, and we're now heading up, and next month will be 15 years since the Tohoku earthquake. So we're getting close to the eve of that anniversary. And we reflect on the hundreds of thousands of volunteers that traveled north to Tohoku and Sendai and Ishinomaki to help with that. But I've heard before that the Kobe earthquake was described as the birth of volunteering in Japan. We were over there, people said that to us. But it's interesting, in your paper, you argue that actually self-help in these disasters was far less intensive than pre-modern times. Back then, there was far more likelihood of this happening, and that social fabric was there. Can you just tell us about that in terms of what things might have been like without this engineering mindset and actually focus on that social cohesion piece?
Well, first we have to qualify, of course. Now it's very hard to actually talk about historic disasters and to quantify citizens' involvement there. So I don't want to overemphasize that. The volunteering was a bit different. So in Kobe, we saw a failure of government response. So for the first 2 or 3 days, the military wasn't actually alarmed, and official government-led disaster response didn't take place. So in Kobe, we had then tens of thousands of volunteers rushing into the city and digging out people. Because government had failed so badly, and that really led to this blossoming of civil society, of citizen-based activism and so forth. In Tohoku, on the other side, it felt very, very well organized there. So you would arrive and people would send you to places where you could kind of volunteer. The military was very quick. I think also the American military was there to respond and to support the Japanese self-defense forces. So that was really a very professionally led reconstruction. And I think also this was necessary, probably because it was such a remote area. So in the end of the day, we really need to see it in a context. In Kobe, it's a metropolitan area. You can get there from Nara, from Osaka, from Kobe within an hour, and in engage and help and respond where you really need it. In Tohoku, on the other side, we saw a kind of professionalization, but maybe that is also very strongly owed to the geography of the disaster as well and where it unfolded. So it's hard to compare these things. In fact,
I just want to ask a question because you sparked my recovery interest when you said it. You were talking about earlier in the conversation around, you know, what does it actually mean to build back better? And we're talking about the you know, demography issue and then what does that actually mean for when we enter into that recovery? But I guess the question to you is, are we actually now at a point where we need to consider how cities transform rather than recovery? Do we actually need to actually change this paradigm in some of these places like Japan where, you know, we've got these complexity of issues crisscrossing each other and making recovery, maybe it isn't actually about recovering, but it's about transforming. What's your ideas or your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, the game changer was really when I read a very old book by Jane Jacobs, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, 1961, and realizing that basically, a city is a complex ecosystem that is constantly changing, that is actually never really stable. Neighborhoods are degenerating, neighborhoods are flourishing, neighborhoods are booming. And then as urban planner, you would want to tweak them in order to harness the complexity that exists within a city. A city is made up of many complex systems, economic systems, social systems, cultural systems, many social networks, many relationships, economic relationships, how different businesses collaborate with one another. And modernist urban planning ignored all of that and wasn't interested in that. And modernist urban planning had this ontology, this worldview of a city that is firmly plannable, that can be designed and built from scratch and engineered from scratch. And if we just design it nice enough, it will just work. But Jane Jacobs really told us that you can't really replicate the natural complexity of a city, of something that is so complex. So planning needs to intervene, needs to harness what is there, and needs to be careful not to destroy what is there as well. So coming back to your question, so the city is, if we assume that the city has always changed, that the city has never been stable, it's of course a matter of course that reconstruction as well cannot go back to one particular state, but we need to see the whole picture. Alvin Weber and Horst Whittle coined this term wicked problem in 1973 in a paper saying that the real world problems are very strongly interconnected and interdependent in very complex ways. And we need to acknowledge this kind of complexity. We need to see the full picture of the challenges that we're confronted with. And we're coming back now to the beginning of our conversation, the quadruple disaster. So it's not enough just to build back and to harden the city against the next tsunami, but we need to think about how will this region change due to climate change, how will it change due to economic transformation, how will it change due to demographic shifts, and how will we need to design accordingly in order to design an emergent structure that is able to accommodate that kind of future change and is able to transform. So I think we need to start to learn and appreciate change as something normal, appreciate this kind of concept of ecological resilience as well, that we can move the system into a kind of different, more stable equilibrium rather than going back to the old normal.
So I think we've spoken a lot today about this technocentric engineering style approach to disaster management in Japan. That applies to other places as well. But it makes me think, isn't this similar to what we're trying to do with climate change adaptation in terms of, in many ways, we're just trying to engineer our way out of our problems?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're part of the same, two sides of the same coin. Disaster resilience and regenerative resilience and adapting our cities to what climate change is bringing to us. Engineering will have to play a role, but I'm a very firm believer in collective creativity as well, in community resilience, social resilience. So we don't know yet what climate change will bring locally. It manifests itself very differently locally. And there might be also phenomena that we don't even have on the radar yet because we're not there yet with research. So for me, of course, what the engineers are doing is very important, and they need to do what they are doing, particularly in a case like Tokyo. You just have to build these kind of gigantic underground spaces now because there is so little green space left. But on the other side, I think it will be also important to involve the citizens more in future dialogues, to have conversations about where we want to be with our city, with our neighborhood in the next 10, 20, 40, 50 years when we grow old, when we become disabled and so forth. And what will it mean a given economic scenario? What will it mean in different climate change in the scenarios as well? What will it mean for particular disaster scenarios that are triggered by climate change, perhaps as well? Flooding, flash floods, storms, fires, droughts, you name it. So I think this more holistic perspective is needed, and I think we need all hands on deck, particularly in less affluent societies as well. Of course, in Japan, we can do that. We can give that to the engineers because we have the money here. We have the expertise here. But I don't think that this is an approach that can be readily replicated somewhere else as well, especially where in societies where we have more polarization between rich and poor as well, and more social conflicts as well.
Yeah, this blows me away that when you boil a lot of things down in disaster, it's always about coming back to what's the context that you're working within, and that often defines the solution that you'll obviously follow or the pathway you'll go down. I really like you're obviously starting to unpack around in your mind, you know, what's that healthy middle ground if we were to get this engineering solution? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, as you said, you know, in some spaces, you know, we will have to have engineering solutions, but it's about having that healthy balance of the other side around an engaged citizenship as well. Are you hopeful that, I guess for Japan specifically, that will become a reality?
I think so, yeah. So there were interesting examples, new templates that we saw in Tohoku. For example, there was this project Nigechizu or Escape Map. So you would see people going out and measuring the time from different parts of the city to the next safest evacuation spot for tsunami. And people would go out and people would start conversations as well about taking down a wall here, convincing somebody to sell a piece of land so that we can build a through road here. And that would improve the evacuation time for so and so many people. So going out there, having that conversation, making this part of everyday place governance as well. I think this is really the key. We need to transform Japanese cities anyway. So I think connecting disaster planning or disaster preparation with the transformation to deal with the demographics and so forth, I think that is really a very important path forward. Another example was along the Tohoku coast, historically, during the Edo period, people put these kind of stone markers there at the line of the tsunami with warnings on it that you should never live and build below that tsunami line in order to stay safe. And of course, these things had grown over and people had forgotten because it was made of stone. And I think in the city of Otsuji, there was a schoolboy developing wooden markers, actually, so that these wooden markers would rot away every couple of years, and then designing a kind of festival, taking down the rotten wooden markers and making and putting new ones back. So I think designing these kind of processes, maybe designing them around schools or civic institutions as well, rooting them in civil society and not in government routines alone, will be key. And I think there's a lot of there's a strong climate of experimentation now in Japan because of the depopulation. Young urban entrepreneurs going to rural areas. In some places, people living in depopulating rural towns now being open to experimentation. So there is a lot of prototyping going on. And the key in my view is how to connect these. I think it doesn't make sense to think about disaster preparedness alone and in isolation, but it has to become part of greater future dialogues about the habitats that we're living in and that we're growing old in and pass away at some point.
Yeah. And I mean, the fascinating part is that like it's because those disasters happen so frequently in Japan that there's, I know that the line of cherry blossoms, I think Sakura trees it's called in Japan and those sort of initiatives that are there to, I know in Rikens and Takara, there's these buildings that have been left there as a reminder and you're constantly thinking, well, this is a tsunami risk here and we should do something about it. And I think that frequency leads to opportunities for entrepreneurialism, which I think is really good. And as we see more of those in not just Japan, but around the world, places like Australia need to contribute to that as well, whether it's in the Pacific Islands, where those places are seeing increases in sea rises and those sorts of things, opportunities exist to work in those places. But plenty more we could discuss, but out of time. So Christian, wanted to thank you for joining us today and walking us through your experience of the earthquake, the tsunami, and your recent paper and fascinating idea on what pre-modern Japan looked like and how things are shaping up today. So that was really fascinating. We've shared some links in the show notes to your work at Vassar University and some of the projects we've discussed today. And you can also find photos and clips from our time in Tokyo and Japan on our website at memyselfdisaster.com and across our social channels. Christian Dimmer, thanks for joining us on Me, Myself and Disaster.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for on the show today. Join us again next time on Australia's leading disaster podcast as we talk to more interesting guests from across the world about their experiences during disasters. We'll catch you then. Me, Myself and Disaster is a production of Beyond Disaster. Find out more at beyonddisaster.au.